and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is September 25th, 2025, and this is episode 551. I am the co-host of Radio Warnerd, Mark Ames in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show, please, at patreon.com/ Radio Warnerd. And unfortunately, today I'm not on the line with my co-host and the man the show's named after, John Dolan, a.k.a. The Warnerd, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, because as those of you who follow Radio Warnerd or on the Facebook page, the Radio Warnerd community probably know, John took a nasty fall out in Calabria, Italy, which would be the front part of the boot bottom of Italy. John and Catherine, as you know, they live in the heel in Apulia. And John had a nasty bump welt. It would count for a real war wound in any normal war situation. I know he went to the hospital. They were checking him out. I just got a note actually about an hour before recording from his wife Catherine that he was discharged. They're in a hotel in Calabria in the city there, and they're going to be there so that John can relax, sleep it off, and have himself checked. They're going to be there for, I think, a week or so. So I'm not sure when John is going to be. I don't want to push anything. I mean, a fall on the head is a very serious thing. So I don't want to push anything. So either today will be the only show without John, or we might do a couple more. I've already talked to a couple of other Radio Warnerd guest faves about it, just in case, if we have to, about filling in while John recovers. So, let's get to our interview today with Ben Aris of B&E and Telenews. The good news for John about this is, this is something I can cover. It's primarily about finance and economics. And as John has reminded the show many, many times, he don't like that subject too much, and was not a big fan of math. So I feel like if there's one or two subjects, let's say, that if we have to be without John, that I could cover, you know, more or less without him, although of course it's always better with him, it would be finance and war, or anything involving Russia. So let's get to our interview with Ben Aris. Okay, we are really happy to have back with us friend of the show, previous Radio Warnerd guest, Ben Aris. Ben has been with us covering the sort of financial economic side of the Ukraine war since the eve of the war. And then we did an episode with Ben within a week or two, I think, after Russia's big invasion in February 2022. And one of the things that Ben very presciently predicted, not that he had to summon up ghosts and gods, I mean, it was pretty clear actually in hindsight, was that Germany, the engine of Europe, was basically kind of committing suicide by going along with sanctions that were going to really harm the German economy. And here we are now, where Germany and Europe are incredibly stagnant and drowning under greater loads of debt, and at the same time trying to massively upspending for the war. So first of all, Ben, thanks for coming back on Radio Warnerd to talk about, you know, the latest in the economic side.
Mark, great to be here, yeah.
Great, thanks. Ben, by the way, real quickly, is the founding editor of B&E and Telenews. We will be posting links, of course, to Ben's articles and to B&E and Telenews. And Ben has a long history. I first met Ben out in Moscow back in the ancient 1990s. So he knows that region very well, even though BNE and Telenews has really expanded into other parts of the world, which we'll be talking about. So Ben.
Yeah, we see the global scene now.
Right, exactly. So, you know, look, when we talk a lot, obviously we talk about wars on this show, Radio War Nerd. And a lot of times when we talk about wars, you know, you talk about wars won or lost due to manpower or technologies or leadership or, you know, strategies or luck or whatever. But like one thing that is common to well, all wars, but that plays a huge role in all wars, and especially, you know, over the last couple hundred years, is finance. You have to finance the wars. Kingdoms fall over poor financing of wars. I mean, the French monarchy probably collapsed because of its finances from losing the Seven Years' War and then bankrupting itself, you know, by continuing it through the American Revolution. So today, anyway, we're going to talk about financing and the Ukraine war because especially since it turned into a war of attrition, finance and the financial health of each side is extremely important and for both sides, as well as manpower, which we know Ukraine, of course, is on the poorer end of that. So I'd like to get into some of the articles you've written, a couple of long reads you wrote for BNE and Telenews this month on the state of European finances, because Europe and the U.S. have been financing Ukraine's war effort since the beginning. And it's a huge effort. And those outlays have caused political fractures and crises in a lot of Western countries, including here. So Trump, of course, is shifting the burden of the war onto Ukraine. MAGA has been for doing that since the campaign season. And Trump is doing that. In fact, that kind of weird rambling post he just put up on Truth Social about how Russia's a paper tiger, et cetera. When you read through that rambling post, he's basically saying, the war is all yours, Europe. This should be easy. They're a paper tiger. Good luck to you. Buy our weapons. So Ben, let's first talk about, you know, the financing of this war. Well, actually, first let's talk about, yeah, how much Europe is paying right now to finance the war. And then
Get into that, the financing, you're right. This was the counter of the European Union, the West, from day one. If you remember, on 26th of February, when the invasion started, there was a press conference, I think 2 days later, and von der Leyen, the EU commissioner, stood up and hit Russia with a series of really extreme sanctions. And the two things they went after for straight away was to freeze $300 billion of central bank reserves that are held in Western banks, largely in Euroclear in Brussels. This was half of Russia's reserves, and it came completely out of left field. No one was expecting that. And the second thing they did was to ban Russia's use of the dollar, the SWIFT sanctions. They banned the use of SWIFT, so Russia can't make any, it basically can't use the dollar, it can't make any international transfers. And the idea was to wreck the Russian economy, to cause an economic collapse by hitting it with financial sanctions. And it did. It caused a shock. I mean, Russia nearly went into crisis in the first few months. And then it's followed up, and most of the sanctions have gone after things that make money, primarily the oil and gas exports. And that, too, was trying to strip Russia of its main source of income to bring it to its knees. And amazingly, it hasn't worked. That the frozen assets, that was very painful, but Russia still has $300 billion in cash, and it just got rid of, and it sold off. I mean, Putin saw this coming. He sanction-proofed the economy by selling off all of his American T-bill assets. It had nothing left by the time the war started. So he knew what was going to happen and got ready for it. And then they switched all the cash reserves, money reserves, into Chinese yuan. And half of the reserves now are yuan, and the other half is gold. And that, again, can't be sanctioned. And you can sell gold even if you're not in the SWIFT system.
And Russia's a major producer of gold.
And it's got whatever it is, like 150 billion, it's gone up now. And Russia's reserves, its value of its reserves has actually gone up 100 billion. So, I mean, it had 300 billion left in the bank at home when the war started. And that's now worth 400 billion. And a lot of that is because gold's gone from whatever it was, 1,700 at the start of the war, to 3,500 now because of the war. And everybody else is buying gold. And they're all buying gold partly because America sanctioned, banned the use of the dollar. So all the other central banks in the world, particularly the Global South, is like, we don't want to be exposed to that risk. You know, you can't just confiscate our international reserves. That's the bedrock of the stability of our currency and our countries. And, oh, you can confiscate it. So, you know, screw the dollar. We're getting into gold.
That's interesting. I haven't heard people. In fact, I was like listening to somebody, some finance people talking about why gold keeps going up. And I hadn't really heard them make the point you've made, but that makes sense. There's a politics behind it, and it makes sense. Yeah.
No, it's an insurance because the value of gold doesn't change because it's physical and there's a limited amount. So you, you know, with fiat currencies like the dollar or the ruble, they change value because, you know, it's a promise. But gold is a physical thing with value. And because now there's a global move by everybody to get more gold. I mean, the Chinese just this week offered all these emerging markets, like, don't keep your money, your gold, in the Federal Reserve in America, which a lot of people do.
Right.
Give it to us, move it to Shanghai, and it'll be safer there.
Interesting.
So there's a big gold story going on in parallel.
Right.
But then moving on, you know, looking at funding the war. So these articles I did, I've just been trying to get my head around it because I was very skeptical, given that it's clear that Trump is pulling out of the war. And until under the Biden administration, Europe's always been in the lead, but America was providing about 40% of all the funding. And Ukraine's been getting about $50 billion a year from external partners. Half, just a bit less than half, was from the States. But Trump sent nothing since he took office. So this year, it's all been on Europe. And I was getting dubious, given the state of the European economies, how they were going to take on the American share. And moreover, the cost of the war is going up. And digging into the Russian budget and the Ukrainian budget, about how they're going to fund their deficits, the first thing that jumps out is at least half of Ukraine's funding comes from external sources. It doesn't have the resources at home, nor the bond market, nor the domestic savings to be able to pay for this war. So it gets about $50 billion. It needs $50 billion altogether. And this year it's short.
$50 billion a year.
Just for, and this is just for the government. Keeping the government running. You've got another $50 billion of military spending. But the budget's talking about running the government. And so the deficit, the official deficit, is around just under $50 billion. And it's short this year somewhere between $8 and $19 billion. And next year it's going to be short. Before it was saying $37 billion. But the IMF just said, like, because the war's going to go on for longer and the costs are going up, actually, you're short $65
billion. Wow.
And given that the whole West, including the States, was donating collectively $50 billion, suddenly the price tag is getting enormously expensive. You know, in effect, Europe has to double, more than double, what it's been giving at a time when its economies are collapsing. Ironically, because of the bounce-back effect of the sanctions on Russia. Mm. And looking at the budget, the Russian budget also has a huge deficit, about the same size. However, Russia has no external funding whatsoever. It's been cut off because of the SWIFT, but it doesn't need it. that just from domestic taxes, plus its ability to issue bonds to its own banking sector, it can cover all of its deficit. Plus, it has a reserve fund which covers all of the deficit for this year. Plus, there is the Russian deficit is going to be something on the order of 3 trillion rubles. That's around 300 billion. However, there's 20 billion of liquidity in the banking sector. That's enough to cover the budget's deficit, to this year's budget deficit, 10 times over. So again, you look at the commentary, everyone's saying, oh, it's running out of money and we can reduce the oil revenues. But then there's another myth, in so much as the sanctions have been aimed at the oil revenues, because that's the thing you can sanction. And everyone has in their mind thing since the whole, like, Russia's a petrol station, a gas station masquerading as a country. Everyone focuses on the oil. But the oil only makes up just a bit more than 20% of the budget revenues. And VAT, just mundane value-added tax, makes up about 35%. And you can't sanction that, because how can you sanction the sale of, like, eggs and cigarettes in a shop in Moscow? You can't touch them. So that's the main source of income. And now we're in this game, like, Ukraine needs more money, Europe's going to have to pay, Europe's cash-strapped, Russia is having a hard time, budget deficit is swelling, it's not doing particularly well, the economy's slowing down. But, you know, it's in a war. It's been in a war for just over 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And that's starting to bite. But again, looking at the finances, being hard-headed about it, I don't see that there's a particular problem. And the team at the Ministry of Finance are dealing with all of this as best they can, and they're doing a pretty good job, if you ask me.
Well, and they also have the central banker, Elvira Nabiulina, who is has already had a stellar reputation. And it seems like, as you said, that Putin sort of prepared for this so as not to be... I mean, Putin came to, you know, his sort of rose up in the 90s, which was a period when, because Russia was so pathetically in debt to the West, it really didn't have sovereignty over its own political decisions. And so, I think this informed Putin's real kind of austere approach to finances.
He's been running austerity budgets. I mean, I think he's been preparing for this war since at least 2012. Because he got Nabiulina to build up the reserves to this incredible 600 billion, and at the same time to pay down the debt. And that's another, I mean, when you're talking about sanction proofing a country, you know, he brought external debt down to 15% of GDP. And in Italy, it's like whatever it is, 130. Most of the European countries are over 110. At the Maastricht Treaty, if everyone had to reapply to rejoin the EU, the Maastricht Treaty sets the maximum debt to GDP at 60%. And the only people that meet that are the Poles.
Right.
Germans are close to 69%. Everyone else is way over. And Russia's 15%. Because you can't sanction someone who doesn't borrow.
Yeah.
Because you, that's your only leverage over them.
Yeah.
You can't cut them off from their money and the country will collapse. Russia is self-funded from just what it has. I mean, redirecting the oil exports from Europe to India and China was important. Mm-hmm. But even you know, if you hamper that business, which has been hampered, it still works financially just because you're totally reliant on domestic resources.
So let's get back to Europe. Let's dive deeper, that is, into Europe. Because, you know, as we've been saying, Trump and the U.S. are handing the war over to Europe. And Trump has been leaning hard, going back to his first term, on the Europeans to increase their defense spending. Europe, since the invasion in 2022, I think, and then especially since this year, the European kind of governing elites have wanted to increase defense spending, and some of them really have. But they also have, a lot of countries have major constraints on them, financial constraints. That, I mean, they have, you know, as they would say, major contradictions in their economies. Mm. So maybe we could talk about some of the major players here, like Germany, Poland, which is an interesting story, and then, you know, counter that to France and the UK, which are in pretty dire shape. Yeah.
So, I mean, to give you an overview, I mean, Poland is the one in the best shape. And they constitutionally limit their debt to 55%. And they've done that. So they've got the wiggle room. Plus, the Polish economy is booming. So they've got, and they're in the process, because of all this uncertainty, because of the military war going on just across the border from them, they're now launched into building up the largest conventional army in Europe. And so previously at the Welsh summit, whenever it was 10 years ago, everyone agreed to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Since then, almost nobody did. But the Poles, at the more recent NATO summit in The Hague, Trump bullied everybody into increasing that to headline 5%, in reality 3.5% on defense by 2036. So there's a long lead time. Yeah. And Poland is already there. It's spending 4.7% this year on GDP on defense because it's building this army, and we'll get to 5% next year, and it can afford it. The economy is healthy, as I said. So.
Why is its economy so strong compared to a lot of other economies? I mean, it's defense spending part of it, or
no? It's just come of age. It's been taking in these EU subsidies. It's been investing into infrastructure. The mentality of the people is work hard, build for the... You know, it's the Wirtschaftswunder that we saw post-war in Germany. You've got a whole generation now of people who are building new lives, building businesses. You had relatively low wage costs compared to the rest of Europe because it was... when I first moved to Germany 20 years ago, you know, everybody had a Polish cleaner. And since I've been here, they've all left and gone home. Because there are better prospects in Poland than there are in Germany. And the cleaners are now all Ukrainians. Mm. And it's a tech hub, you know, and everything's new.
They're still doing a lot of manufacturing for the, you know, German manufacturing plants.
And it makes sense, too, because, you know, the wages are still have been lower.
Right.
And the government's been pretty progressive, and it doesn't suffer from the same sort of bureaucracy that Germany's got itself into, ossified itself. And as a result of all of that, it's starting to rival Germany as an engine, because it's also got the population. So the internal market is large enough, whatever it is, 35 million people, that you start, you know, fueling your growth from your own population. And if you look around Europe, there's actually very few countries that are in that position. Because most of them, you know, Czech Republic, Hungary, 5 million people, you know, you have to do some sort of trade. But Poland can grow just on selling stuff to its own people. Right. So it's doing well. The next best is Germany. And that's a function, again, of debt that it's just been very prudent. And it had this special law, this constitutional law called the Schuldbremse, the debt brake, that forbade the government from borrowing a lot. So its debt's only 69%. And it's invested a lot in infrastructure, and it has manufacturing base is twice the size of anybody else's in terms of share of GDP. So it's in a much better shape, but it's been heavily, heavily hit by the bounce back from the sanctions. And particularly, as we said, in the first weeks of the war, the end of cheap Russian energy, the gas, is gone. And so it's deindustrializing. It's
cheap long term. I mean, it's important. Yeah. You made that point. It's not even just that it's cheap, but that it was fixed for a long term. That's how you build an industrial policy off that. Yeah.
Exactly. And now you're dependent on the spot price of an LNG, which is a commodity like oil. And like in this year, it's coming. But last year, Germany's competing with Asia, Japan in particular, and so all the LNG disappears down there. In 2022, the prices increased in Europe 20-fold. Wow. And Russia made, you know, a ton of money. Normally, it's all-time high current account surplus. In 2021 was about $120 billion. In 2022, in the middle of the first year of the war, it made over $200 billion just on selling oil and gas to Europe. Europe remains the biggest customer, even now remains the biggest customer for Russian oil and gas, particularly gas. which is insane. So Europe's sending more money to Moscow to pay for energy than it's sending to Ukraine, which is insane, which is one of the things that Trump is complaining.
I was going to say that's one of the things Trump said, because when he gets lectured by the Europeans, he turned it back on them and said, you're financing Russia's war, basically.
He's right, actually. Yeah, that's one of the few things he's right about. But and then to the basket cases in Europe are Italy, France, UK are all particularly bad. Italy's got incredibly high debt, something like 130%. But ironically, thanks to things like tourism, it continues to run a small current account surplus. So it kind of works in a crazy kind of Italian way.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. The current account, that just means that enough money is always coming in to cover whatever's going out.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because if you think back to like the financial crises, the Asian financial crises and so on in the 90s and beyond, it's oftentimes it's because you have this current account deficit where all of a sudden you can't meet what you owe, and then you just have a complete collapse at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not healthy at all. It's overborrowed, but think of it as like a credit card debt. You've got a massive credit card debt, but you can cover the monthly payments with your paper rounds. And so
countries have crazy interest payments as a portion of their budgets and GDP. Could you talk about that a little bit too?
Well, that's France and the UK.
Right.
Their debt. Again, in GDP terms, it's not as high as as Italy's, but the debt service is getting to the point where 4 out of 5 bonds that the UK is issuing now go to paying debt service. It's become a Ponzi scheme, in so much as that you keep rolling the debt over, so you have to issue new debt to pay the old debt. Mm-hmm. But as people get more and more nervous, the yields go up, so it progressively gets more expensive. And France is in the same position, to the point now where the sovereign debt has become more expensive than the corporate debt.
Sovereign debt being the government issue.
The government, yeah. Uh-huh. So it means the market trusts the government less to pay back its bonds. It thinks the government's more likely to default than a company.
That's crazy.
That's nuts. Yeah. That's absolutely nuts. And both the finance ministers in the UK and France have admitted that they're close to being forced to go and ask for an IMF bailout.
That's insane. Yeah, I heard the French, the outgoing, or who was just deposed, prime minister saying that, which was a real shocker. But it seems to me, based on what I've heard and what I read in your articles, that the UK is in a particularly bad predicament, even compared to France. Would you say that's right?
Yeah, because, I mean, everything's going wrong. The share of, from the budget, what they have to pay from debt servicing is going up and up. It should be around 3%. It's like 8%. This is like emerging markets level of stress. And the economy is like flat on its back. All faith in the government is like evaporating. We've now got the rise of the crazy far right in the UK. Mm-hmm. This guy, Farage, who's like a British Trump, is now leading the polls with 32%, and the Tories and Labour are on 16%. It's insane. Same in Germany, the far right. I mean, the far right's rising. I mean, this is the political consequence because the people in these countries, they're asking, like, why are our governments sending, like, tens of billions of euros to Ukraine every year? It's a country that's not in the EU. It's not a NATO member. It has very little to do with us. And yet, at the same time, you're cutting essential services, schools, hospitals, infrastructure investment at home. Why are we paying for this war? And the populist right-wing parties have all leapt on this, and they're making a lot of hay. And so we've now, for the first time, I think ever, got the far-right parties leading simultaneously in the UK, Farage, in France, Le Pen, and in Germany, the AfD. And it probably means that, well, I don't know if we're going to have change of government and far-right governments. In the UK, we could. In France, we could. In Germany, because of proportional representation, probably not. But, you know, this is not good politically. And it's also a trap for the European politicians because they can't act decisively with reforms because then that just will cause more pain and then that will just promote the far right even further. So they're stuck in this sort of limbo between trying to help Ukraine and not being able to, trying to fix their own economies and not being able to because they can't do anything decisive. And so they're just sort of managing a slow decline while the situation, of course, in Ukraine gets worse and the costs of that keep going up. So it's just looking worse and worse. It's like a death by a thousand cuts.
In one of your pieces, Europeans face recession, financial crises as they struggle to boost defense spending. You point out that in Germany, which is one of the countries, of course, it's the financial engine of Europe, but it's also in among the best shape of any economy in Europe. Nevertheless, unemployment is at its highest in 10 years. And Merz last month came out and called for basically cutting, housing and child allowances, unemployment payments, family supplements, aid programs for the needy, subsidies for caring for the sick and elderly, while at the same time they're going to increase the defense budgets pretty substantially. And there, as you write, there are all these, I don't know what else to call them, these, you know, financial vehicles, gimmicks, whatever you call them, new loan vehicles or something, allowing for a massive expansion of defense spending. Could you talk about some of these, you know, these like loan vehicles that the EU is trying to set up so that to kind of monkey around with the books?
If you do the math, that Ukraine, at the end of the day, needs about $100 billion a year for both military and running the government. And that has to come from Europe. And Europe doesn't have it. The problem with Italy, UK, and France in particular is because they have so much debt, they can't raise more. And there's, put it this way, there's two huge sums that need to be spent of 800 billion euros. The first 800 billion is the money that Europe needs to invest in its own defense in order to reach this NATO target of 3.5 that Trump's demanding. And that's not counting, that's not starting to include Ukraine. That's money it has to spend itself on its own defense. A little bit of that can go towards Ukraine. But at the same time, you've got this, Europe's lost it's going backwards. It's lost its competitive edge. There was this report by the former Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, where he showed in detail that Europe has now fallen well behind both the States and China and can't catch up. And he said that you need to invest 800 billion euros a year on top of the defense spending in order to get back in the game to be competitive. And then on top of that, you have to add another 100 billion a year to support Ukraine. So this is a shit ton of money that just doesn't exist. So Europe is casting around trying to find ways of funding Ukraine. And moreover, obviously, it doesn't want to take it from its own tax base, which it has been, because that's just going to make the problems at home worse. So the only pool of money available to do this is the Russian frozen 300 billion, which would cover everything. So the trouble is that sovereign, that's Russia's money. It's unprecedented. It's been frozen, but it still belongs to Russia, which means Europe can't take it and spend it. It's illegal. If they do that, then it's appropriation of, you know, a country's sovereign money. And the upshot of doing that would be to completely undermine trust in the euro. And money is based on trust. If you undermine the trust in the euro, then that causes you huge problems with the valuation. No one will trade in it anymore. And it could also undermine the banking sector because if, again, you've had like large amounts of another country's money seized, stolen, if you ask the Russians, then you could see massive bank capital flight, just everyone pulling their money out of European banks, which would cause a bank crisis. You're going to have a wave of lawsuits, not just from the Kremlin, which it will probably win, but also all of the investors who are connected to this, who are making losses from what they deem to be illegal action by the EU. And again, they have a good case. And so the individual banks will be hit. So it's just going to cause a shitstorm. I mean, it really is going to cause a mess if they go down that road, but there's no other money available. And then apart from that, the EU are trying to think of clever ways of raising more money. So they had this, it's called SAFE.
Security vehicle. Action for Europe, defense loans,
And it created, in the form of debt, which has been handed out, money specifically for defense spending. And that's gone already. That went very quickly. You know, countries like France took 16 billion, Poland took, I think, 40 billion. And that's been very useful for everyone to do defense spending, but that's gone already. There was this Ukraine investment fund, because if you go back a couple of years, everyone was asking this question, how are you going to pay not just to fund the budget and fight the war, but also the reconstruction? Mm-hmm. And again, another massive figure. So in addition to this two lots of 800 billion plus 100 a year for funding the war, you're going to need another 500 billion to rebuild Ukraine when the ceasefire happens. Where's that going to come from? Yeah. And actually, there's no money dedicated. So what they just did earlier this year, they set up this Ukraine investment fund where von der Leyen was talking about, quote unquote, unlocking $10 billion in investments. So the EU seeded this fund with 200 million. And the idea being it's going to have like special backing and it's going to have government support. And like, you know, that means that you can't be, you know, defrauded or anything because you've got effectively you've got a political guarantee. But I talked to fund managers. I know, you know, I've been hanging out with emerging market fund managers for years. And they're like, yeah, Ukraine's a great story. But, you know, you're dreaming if I'm going to go in there anytime in the next 5 years, because what if there's a second war? Until I'm sure that Russia's not going to attack again, I'm not investing a penny. So unlocking this $10 billion is just not going to happen. And they keep coming up with these ideas. I mean, the latest thing with seizing or stealing the $300 billion of frozen money is they're talking about these reparations loans?
Right, yes.
And they're going to issue some EU-guaranteed zero-interest bonds. So technically, the argument is that, look, we haven't touched the central bank's money. It's still in Euroclear, in cash. But we've issued these bonds, which we can then use to make loans to Ukraine using this cash. But technically, the bonds separate us from seizing the money. And so it still technically belongs to Russia. And so we haven't broken the law.
So yeah, because they're trying to come up with, and leave it to finance people to always come up with a scheme. Because, you know, so they're saying this isn't that we've taken the money. This is a bond backed by the money or something.
But no, they use the money, which comes from the bonds. But the bonds are guaranteed by the EU members. And this is one of the big problems with this idea, is that if the war ends and it's decided to, the decision to keep the money frozen has to be unanimously renewed every 6 months. So someone like Hungary has the option of vetoing that renewal, at which point the money has to be returned to Russia. But then suddenly the EU member that backed, guaranteed one of those bonds is suddenly on the hook for the cash that they've lent and could get whatever it is. They're talking about 130 billion euros coming out of this scheme. So suddenly all the EU members could be suddenly on the hook for 130 billion euros that they're going to have to pay to give Russia back its money, in effect. So the talks on this have got tied up. Everyone's not happy about it. But as I say, because everyone's so desperate for money, and that countries like France, Italy, and UK, they cannot borrow. They're so up against it already. They've hit the maximum on their cards that they have no option. Otherwise, as I was arguing the other day, I'm not just the only one now, is that Ukraine doesn't get any more money and there's a macroeconomic collapse and then it's all over. And this is, you're staring this in the face now.
What is keeping them in the game? I mean, it's clear that Russia's invasion at least at first, genuinely did frighten at least the political elites of Europe, and particularly Western Europe, and but Europeans in general. But as time has gone on, like, the idea is to prop up Ukraine in order to, I don't know, stabilize the European order. But the longer the war goes on, the more Europe is being destabilized. So one would think the answer then is to end the war. But that's not so easy either, because the war is not going to be ended on terms that are going
to make it go there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. I mean, in the beginning, it was up in the air, and then, you know, the Russian invasion went horribly wrong, and they were supposed to get Kiev in 3 days, and it didn't happen, and everyone was shocked that the Russians screwed it up. And with the air superiority, they should have taken control of the skies in the first week, and then that didn't happen. And then they came in with the armor, and these teams of three wielding these shoulder-mounted javelin missiles, you know, blew the Russian heavy armor to pieces. So we were like, yeah, it's going to work. And then at that point, the West started pouring weapons in. And we'll stand with Ukraine as long as it takes, and there's going to be a victory. But then, you know, as you said right at the beginning, you have this initial blitzkrieg phase where you can have a quick victory. But then it comes down to finance and industrial production. Mm-hmm. And Putin, from the beginning, put the entire economy onto a war footing and industrialized, weaponized everything. And now that machine is up and running at full tilt. And Ukraine doesn't have that machine, and the West never made those investments into expanding its defense, which is why it has to spend so much money now catching up. It was an insane, missight that they haven't done anything to prepare for this, and suddenly all coming at once. And I agree. I think we're now seeing Europe being reactive in pretty much everything. And the politicians have painted themselves into a corner by having, you know, ramped up and rah-rahed this war for so long. Politically, they can't go back. It's going to be suicide. It's another problem with this far right standing at their shoulder with their knives out.
Right.
And they're not being realistic. Again, I'm shocked that people are not writing about the European crisis. Mm-hmm. Europe, as far as I'm concerned, is in a huge crisis, a funding budget, industrial crisis, you know, all the indicators. Like here in Germany, I mean, Germany's in the strongest position, debt-wise, money-wise, and it has actually created $400-500 billion of new borrowing capacity, which it could use to fix itself, fund some of Ukraine. However, the economy is flat on its back because of this energy problem, and it's now just gone into its third quarter of recession. And so it's growing. It's one of the few in Europe that's actually in negative territory now. And France and Britain are not much better. And so how to get out of this? And the politicians are not willing to admit it. They're not willing to admit how badly things are going in Ukraine. They're not willing to admit how badly things are going at home. And the Ukraine issue has been very useful, Putin particularly so, as a scapegoat. And so one of the upshots of this, one of the manifestations, is the constant talk we hear about Russia's getting ready to attack NATO. Russia's getting ready to invade Europe. And I don't know, you've been in Russia a long time. I've been in Russia a long time. Mm-hmm. Listening to the Russians closer, it's just insane. It's not going to happen. The Russians are fully aware that they can't do that. They'll lose. And Lavrov has said it over and over again. I mean, again, he always lies, so maybe there is a grain of truth. But, you know, if the argument against it, if Russia can, after 3 years of war, having fully militarized their economy, if they can only capture 20% of Ukraine and putting their full effort into trying to get the rest of the Donbass, which is what they're doing now, everything, 1,000 guys a week are dying in that campaign, and they can't do it. The idea that they're going to try and march back to Berlin is stupid.
It's preposterous, yeah. But it's clear, and I hear from other people who are in Germany or keep tabs on Germany, that the rhetoric, the sort of popular cultural rhetoric, at least from the politics side, has really changed, especially this year, where they're talking about, they're kind of trying to whip up more war fever among the youth.
Videos. But it's very useful because you've got like serious economic problems.
Yes.
The government's not doing its job. And it's a very useful way of deflecting any and all criticism.
Absolutely.
Because you can just say, well, of course things are going badly and of course we can't spend on this school because we're about to be invaded by Russia and we have to get ready.
I mean, there's an argument also, I want to see what you think about this, that that Merz is trying to borrow a page from Thatcher, maybe more specifically Reagan's old playbook. So the U.S. had suffered through years of stagflation. Mm-hmm. Reagan comes in and he comes in whipping up a huge Cold War II fever that the Soviets are about to take us over and we have to massively increase defense spending, which means massively increasing budget deficits, which the U.S. was okay with doing because they were willing to basically run trade deficits and export jobs. But nevertheless, you know, it retooled the economy. It kind of retooled the whole politics of the economy by re-gearing a lot of economic energy and resources to defense and to finance, because you have to finance the debt that pays for this massive rearmament. And so there's a question of how much do you think it's possible that Merz is thinking along similar lines? Like,
I think he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're talking about is classic Keynesian stimulation. And, mm-hmm. You know, the States wasn't at war with the Soviet Union. It was always a threat. So that massive spending did the job and boosted the economy and gets it going again. Problem Merz has is that he's also created a lot of money, but he's going to put it into defense. I mean, he has infrastructure projects and what have you as well. So the Keynesian boost he's going to get is going to be less, but it should produce some effect. But at the same time, you've got this horrible bleed of money. And Germany, you know, when we talk about the EU supporting Ukraine, actually we're talking about Germany. It's carrying right. about half the bill. So tens of billions. They have this special fund to boost defense before the recent jiggery-pokery with the change in the constitution for 100 billion. But they were struggling to come up with even 10 billion. You know, they basically haven't spent any money with that facility because they had no cash. And he's got more now. But again, he's talking about increasing his allocation to Ukraine from 3 billion to 9 billion. Which is, it's not going to change anything. And it's still, I mean, he said, you were talking about all the cuts he was making. He came out the other day and said, we cannot afford our social system anymore. We can't right. pay for it. And this is Germany, you know, the hospitals, yes. schools. I mean, you know, this is the best in Europe. Yep. This has always been their pride. And they can't afford it anymore. So how are you going to explain that to the electorates? Yeah. And Germany is the one with the money. In Europe, you know, it actually has some space to do that. So, and the rest of the Europe is slipping or sliding into recession. The government just fell in France again, mm-hmm. and their budget's deficit is ballooning as a result, and it was already bad. The same's going to happen in the UK. And so if you've got, I don't know, it's not going to be like an Asian crisis where it's all going to, or the 98 mm-hmm. crisis in Russia where it all blows up overnight. Because they have a lot of investment into infrastructure, and there's the ECB, European Central Bank,
right.
That can help and bail out. And if your bonds are going wobbly like they are in France, then the ECB
they can print money to save themselves, yeah. money that people
yeah.
want.
And yeah. you've got all the other countries in Europe, so you just sort of take some of their money and use it to buy French bonds. And so you can sort of manage it.
Right.
But you're just talking about protracted long-term decline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm starting to compare it to Argentina in 1900, you know, which at the time was the richest country in the world. Then the commodity markets changed and suddenly it was no longer relevant and it sort of just faded away over the next 100 years. So I don't see a sort of, you know, 2008 or 1998 style overnight Asian crisis. But it's just long, slow decay. Yeah. And it comes back to this point, this competitive investment, this $800 right. billion it needs to spend a year to get back in the game. And all talk of that has disappeared because everybody's talking about Ukraine and defense. So we're wasting what resources we have, as far as I'm concerned, on fighting Russia in a war that's not going to happen.
Because ending the war, unless it's with Russia's defeat, which is not going to happen and certainly not going to happen anytime soon, even if it were to happen, ending the war is just so politically costly to the people in power right now. They're not willing to go there. Yeah. I mean, it will kill them. Yeah.
I mean, they're probably going to lose their jobs anyway as the rise of the right, because the people are starting mm-hmm. to complain in all these countries. And they're going to put Le Pen back in. They're going to put Farage in. They're going to put Alice Van Weidel here in Berlin. So they're kind of going to lose their jobs anyway over the next, 2 to 4 years, next round of election cycles. But in the meantime, they're just like trying to make it all work and stick it out. And poor Ukraine is...
Yeah. So you know. Can you tell... I just want to cover a couple more things. I know I've kept you for a while. What is the state of Ukraine's economy? And do you hear from there in Germany and with your contacts, you know, in Russia and the former Soviet Union, you know, what are you hearing about the war? But first, I'm curious about Ukraine's economy from what you're able to glean.
Well, it's basically going through the same cycle as the Russian economy. So we had 2 years, we had like this shock of the war, and then 2 years of strong growth. Again, military Keynesian boost, a massive spending on defense. And then that wore off end of last year, beginning of this year, with the appearance of extremely high inflation. Pretty much the same things happening in Ukraine. It had like 5% growth last year, and the first quarter of this year, it's like down to near zero. And it's struggling. And they're spending, you know, Russia's spending about 37% of its tax take on the war. Ukraine's spending 60%. I mean, they're funneling every penny they have into it. And the continued destruction. That's the other big difference is that, you know, from their power sector, Russia's destroyed every power station that wasn't nuclear. Mm. Half the capacity. So you're struggling to try and repair these things and get them going just to keep the lights on. So it's in an awful state. And you've got a demographic crisis like the world has never seen. You lost 6 million people at the beginning of the war. And more anyone else who can get out will get out. I mean, there's a nice anecdote that Kuleba, the foreign minister...
Right.
Who got sacked in a recent reshuffle. The Zelensky put out an order that all senior diplomats and government officials can't leave the country. And the day before this order was released, Kuleba moved to Poland.
Yeah. He also, didn't he say from there that Ukraine's going to need to import large numbers of South Asians.
Yeah.
So that they have a workforce. And I think there was a census or a kind of an unofficial census that Ukraine just put out where their population is down officially to 28 million about from 52 million in 1991. I mean, it's just, it's unfathomable.
The UN predictions are even worse. I mean, even if there's a ceasefire, then over the next 10, 15 years, it's going to go down to 16. Because all those 6 million that left, 80% of them were women and children. All the girls are gone.
Right.
And again, you look at the surveys, the polls, like no one wants to go back. And again, if there's a ceasefire and they open the borders, take away martial law, then there's another poll saying 1 in 5 of the young people are going to leave. Right. I don't think people are kind of conscious of just how destroyed the Ukrainian economy is. And how awful the prospects are going to be at the end of the war, particularly when there's no real plan to fund this $500 billion repair program that needs to be done.
I feel like that's another big reason why they don't want to bring this war to an end in any sort of painful way that would be
required.
It just
precipitates all of this. And you know, again, I think Europe, the West is just going to walk away in the way that they walked away from Belarus. I mean, here in Berlin, we were marching on 17th of July in 2000. Mm. We stand with Belarus, Tikhanovskaya, what a hero. Mm. 2 years later, it's never mentioned.
Right.
And I think poor Ukraine is going to go the same way. It's like when it's over, everyone's going to know, oh, that was bad. Never mind.
Yeah. All right. I think on that happy note, Ben, we can end this discussion. I mean, none of these have been particularly happy discussions anyway, but
It's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, bottom line, I mean, being a pragmatist, I think we've long passed the point where we should call it a day, because it's not winnable. It never was winnable. But even like, you know, some Black Swan event where you could force Putin to do some sort of negotiation. And he's made various gestures along the way that he's been willing to talk. But the only way out now, I think, is the Finlandization option. And briefly, when Soviet Union fought Finland and Finland lost, they did a peace deal. They gave up 10% of their country. And then afterwards, they adopted this strict neutrality, which the Soviet Union accepted, because it was about, Putin said from the beginning, it's about security, and strict neutrality that satisfied them, our security is ensured by that. And it's one of the demands that Putin's making now, is return, no NATO, return to neutrality. And I think Ukraine's got to say goodbye to those five regions. They're not going to get them back. And do this deal and then start the business of reconstruction.
Yeah. But it's going to be a long time, I think, and a lot more dead on both sides.
Million people. It's insane.
We get there. Anyways, thank you again, friend of the show, Ben Aris from BNE and Telenews, for coming on and talking about the financial side of the Ukraine war.
Always a pleasure. Mark, can I make a quick plug for BNE? If you go to our website, intellinews.com, we write about all this stuff every day. If you look in the right-hand column, there's a button for editor's picks. Sign up to that. That's a daily email digest, which contains the best stories in the last 24 hours. And I write a blog in there every day about talking about all this sort of stuff, a bit more speculative, a bit more analytical about what I'm thinking, which I hope you find interesting.
Right. And we should remind listeners that BNE and Telenews has expanded a lot to a lot of countries, particularly in the global south. And that helped give you another really good insight a couple of years ago in one of our previous episodes about Putin's real strategy of shifting towards the global south, plus China, India, of course. And I know you guys have a presence there.
We have bureaus in Latin America, India, right. Africa. And that whole global south shift, I mean, that's taking over as the main story.
Yeah,
that for
it's
us
paid
is
off.
I think it's going to keep me busy for the next 20 years watching the rise of all of that.
Yeah, good. Okay, thanks again, Ben Aris, BNE and Telenews, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, let's end the episode here. Thanks again to Ben Aris for joining us. Thank you again, everybody, for supporting the show, and Brendan for recording it. And of course, John, get well. I'm sure you're listening to this. So, talk to everyone soon. Bye.